Hello, this is Life Matters. For some of us, recent news reports about missing children will be especially distressing. Cleo Smith was found after only 18 days, which is extremely rare, and the whole country celebrated that. But police are still searching for William Tyrrell, 7 years after he was last seen. All the media attention in these cases can create a sense of fear, generally, about whether or not the children in your life are safe. But what must it be like for families who are still missing loved ones and have been for some time? We'll explore that today on Radio National. How much attention a missing person's case gets can depend on a lot of factors, and the impact of that public attention can have varied effects too. Dr. Sarah Wayland is a missing persons researcher at the University of New England. She's going to help us understand the impact of missing children cases on families. Sarah, thanks for being part of this discussion today. Sarah, sorry, we missed a lot of your response there about what a family who's missing a loved one might be experiencing at the moment watching these stories.
Sorry, Hilary. I think I've resolved my technology now.
Excellent.
What I was talking about was that complexity of having someone missing means that you're highly sensitive to other news articles about missing people. You know, there's over 2,500 long-term missing people in Australia. And those stories about good news for some families or increase of attention around particular searches can be really vulnerable for other families to have to witness.
Indeed, and anyone with empathy could imagine that. How often are missing children found as opposed to not found in Australia?
I think that what's really important to understand is that the current data on people who go missing is that there's about 40,000 police reports every year about the safety and well-being of someone whose whereabouts are unknown. We know from that data about 97 or 98% of those people are located within a relatively short period of time. Those cases involving young people not only have to do with the cases that we see in the media at the moment, but also children who might be absent from care or absent from their family because they've run away at the time. In terms of those cases where there's a potential stranger abduction, that makes up for a very small percentage of those missing persons cases, only 0.6% of that 40,000. So those cases where someone has been taken against their will are the ones that are kind of front of mind in terms of the community's perception. So those young people that go missing and come back because of those other public health related issues like family disconnection are more likely to come back, whereas those where there's a crime that's been committed means that there's a different focus. So their return rate is going to be different.
And what's the process there for a case getting onto the missing persons register? Is it only for long-term missing cold case type cases?
No, not necessarily. I think it's important to recognise that the term missing is such a catch-all phrase. Mm. Like, we understand that missing means absent or lost, but the complexity of the reasons why people go missing means that there's often a unique risk assessment tool that's used to identify when media is going to be most important. So in those cases where there's a stranger abduction or a potential stranger abduction, that role of making sure that child's image is front and centre in the media in terms of an Amber Alert information sent out quickly, you're more likely going to see those cases have more of a profile. The same can be said for other vulnerable conditions, you know, where someone's missing with complex mental health conditions, someone's missing because they require medication, or an older person who might have wandered with dementia. So it's about making that decision quickly about that assessment of risk and then placing that on the register so that people can access that information.
So could it be stressful for families who don't fit those criteria to understand why perhaps their missing loved one hasn't gone up on the register and there's not so much media attention?
Very much so. I completed my PhD about 6 years ago now, and it was about understanding the complexities of hope for families who are left behind when someone goes missing. And even though we say to each other those platitudes of, you know, there's no hierarchy of grief, or if you're experiencing grief, then that's valid. But families of missing people do very much feel that there is a certain amount of attention to those cases where a person was vulnerable or where there's some type of media attention around a crime that's been committed. Those families where they might have cases where there isn't a lot of information as to how the person disappeared, where there's some questions around, did they make the decision themselves or did someone else make that decision for them? They're less likely to get attention, and all families are desperate for that information that might solve the case for them.
And when it comes to Indigenous children, I understand that they are overrepresented in the missing statistics. And there have been some comments from Indigenous advocates since Cleo Smith was found that not enough police and media attention goes towards cases of missing First Nations kids, particularly advocates in WA are saying, look, we don't have that same relationship with the police and they don't seem to pay the same amount of attention and put the same resources into the kids that we report missing. What are some of the factors that might affect that?
I think that what tends to happen in the missing persons space, having worked in it for a really long time, is that we're really limited in Australia in terms of appropriate research being done about understanding the exact uniqueness of the missing persons population and making sure that we hear from communities about what is actually happening. So a lot of the time our perception of going missing is going to be impacted by the media and what's presented up to us, as well as those kind of true crime podcasts that ask for the community to get involved. I do know from work that was done back in 2005 by Griffith University was a focus on the fact that young Aboriginal women are more likely to go missing than any other population group. The challenge is that both from a government perspective and a policing perspective, there isn't a specific focus on Aboriginality and missing in terms of understanding how they can better serve the communities. So I think from a cultural perspective, we need to do better instead of just thinking about missing as a catch-all phrase and thinking that there's one way of assisting those families who are left behind. And that's the responsibility both of police and in terms of government policy.
Sarah, is part of the issue also about the resources that some families have to get out there, do media, advocate for their missing loved ones and just draw on community support? Is that, you know, not the same in all groups in our communities?
No, I think that it's an incredibly white privileged way of thinking about the ways in which families in the midst of significant trauma can mobilise themselves to almost design a media campaign. The media do a great job in terms of taking the story and being able to share it, but the family have to provide the story in the first place. They have to provide the hook and the angle and the images that allow the community to understand that they might want to step in and help you by offering that information. Families, because of trauma issues, potentially because of English language issues, aren't on an even playing field in terms of how they decide to use their own social media, how they might talk or engage with other news outlets. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that I've noticed over the last few years is that we've been able to sometimes rely on other families of long-term missing people to provide information to new families of missing people. And that's been a really unique way of those families who have that historical experience passing on their skills to others. And that includes all of the things that they might think about in terms of, do you share your own mobile phone number when you put out a request for assistance to locate somebody? What do you write in a press release? How do you do an interview? How do you think about the parts of the story that you want to share to bring the person home? And what parts need to retain? You need to retain as some private family stories.
Yes, indeed. We're speaking with Dr. Sarah Wayland, who's a missing persons researcher with a lot of experience in this field, many years of work. She's at the University of New England. So as we've been hearing from Sarah, almost any family in this situation would be throwing whatever they have at the problem. It's just that the opportunities differ. And we also heard from Sarah about the fact that families who have been through this often reach out and help other families. Bruce Morecambe is one of those people, one of those families. His son Daniel was abducted and murdered in 2003 when he was 13. But police didn't solve the case until 2011. Daniel was missing, in inverted commas, for all that time. Bruce Morecambe, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Great to be here, Hilary.
Now, Bruce, how has it been for you watching the Cleo Smith case? How did that affect your family?
Look, it's like everyone in Australia. You know, we were passive observers, just watching the TV and checking out social media and traditional media. But truly, it's a wonderful story. Highly rare, even in a global sense, for a missing child, particularly somebody that had been abducted. It appears by somebody unknown to the child and the family to be returned unharmed. So. A remarkable story. After 18 days, she made it back to her family in what appears to be excellent health. So that's a great story, and we shared, you know, as a family, we shared that fantastic news. Obviously, in William's case, you know, that's still an evolving story there, and unfortunately, it would appear that grim news is the only news that may come forward in William's case. But, yeah, look, it's an uneasy time for the families of missing children, most definitely, because we can relate. For almost 8 years, Daniel was a missing child. And, of course, all those the decades since that time, you know, obviously he was a murder victim. So we have been on both sides of the fence, and neither side is a great place to be. I can certainly say that.
Indeed. And Bruce, I guess in there are some similarities with Daniel's case and William's case. The police investigation shifted to different points of focus and different persons of interest. What's it been like for you seeing the media attention on those investigations in William Tyrrell's case and hearing about some of the different ways it's been approached?
Yeah, look, I've had a number of comments, some from Queensland police officers that have were on Daniel's case, you know, really at the pointy end of it, as well as, you know, family and friends. And and certainly Denise and myself, we recognised what's in the media, at least. There's an enormous number of similarities. It's quite remarkable. The protracted and drawn out police investigation, and then suddenly there's a twist, there's a turn, and there appears, long way to go yet, that the police are drilling down on something that would appear perhaps to be fairly central in the early investigation days, very similar circumstances to when police did a review and a covert operation, and of course we also had a coronial inquest, which is remarkably similar to William's case, and it would appear that that gathered momentum, where there was a significant energy restored to let's go back to the very start and review all that information. So I absolutely see you know, police reviews, the coronial inquest process, to be really critical in drilling down and finding some of the early answers that perhaps were dismissed or missed at that time.
And Bruce, what about your relationship with the media? Because you and your wife, Denise, were so brave and open with your time and getting up in front of the media, and that was integral to keeping Daniel's case alive in people's minds right around the country for a really long period of time. What kinds of feelings did your experience with the media leave you with?
Yeah, look, we always have a great respect for the media. And I think in turn, because we made ourselves available, we actually sometimes created, when we felt the momentum in the public, Daniel's case was drifting into that cold case area, we actually created media stunts, if I term it like that, in a fairly crude fashion, where some information that had been received by us personally, obviously we'd pass that on to the police. But when we weren't receiving any direct information from police that we're heading in a healthy direction, you know, we're tracking this strategy at this time, we were terribly frustrated as parents of Daniel. You know, we wanted a result, and we wanted to contribute to the process, to the investigative work that was out there. And while we did do some physical searches ourselves of bushland, or sometimes meet people that said they knew things, largely what we could do was stay out of the door knocking, etc. We'd leave that to professional people like the police.
Mm.
But what we could do was harness the energy that was out there and make sure that leads were coming in from the public. So our relationship with the media. And some of the things we did was obviously some flyers and those sorts of things, bumper stickers, etc., which has been done numerous times by others, of course. But I on a couple of occasions actually had we created some signs. They were old house doors that we had in the shed. I had them at our disposal. I just crudely painted those, and I wrote on them with a permanent marker, some information in dot point that I felt would generate perhaps some questions within the media, and perhaps somebody out there in Australia land would come forward, ring Crime Stoppers, knock on the police door at their local police station and say, hey, I know something about that. Mm. So we had a great relationship with the police and an excellent relationship with the media. And sometimes there were occasions where you didn't want to do a media event, but we muscled up and did it simply because I always felt we owed the media something. They didn't expect it, but I just wanted to do that to thank the people of Australia and also to thank the media and the searchers that were out there, because, of course, there's lots of SES volunteers that comb the bush in really difficult conditions doing those searches. And let's face it, most of those searches draw a blank.
Yes.
And when they start the day, they're ever hopeful, but they're likely not to find that crucial piece of evidence. So,
and Bruce,
pats on the back to them.
Yes, and I know that you've started a foundation, the Daniel Morcombe Foundation, which helps to give back to the community and try and help other families in similar situations too. We're speaking with Bruce Morcombe and Dr. Sarah Wayland, missing persons researcher at the University of New England. Sarah, how much control do families have when it comes to their relationship with the media and the public? It sounds like it might vary quite widely.
It does. I think that what I've seen over the years, exactly what Bruce said, is a really lovely emerging relationship with the media and with families. You know, they've all got a shared common goal where they're hoping for an outcome. The other challenge is that when there is a lot of grey areas in a missing persons case, that you'll have some media that will be incredibly respectful of the boundaries of some families, and other media outlets seeking to almost do the investigation themselves and bring up additional information. Families also acknowledge that sometimes that repetitive speaking about the very worst day in their life can be really challenging to sit with over long periods of time, particularly those families that I've interviewed that are kind of 10, 20, 30 years down the track of waiting. They know that when an anniversary comes up, that they might be able to reach out and ask for some media attention. But there's also some incredible sadness of when they do that and the media say, I'm sorry, you'll need to bring something new to the table, or there needs to be another hook or another angle. Because that unintentionally says to families, the community no longer cares about your missing person. So it's a really tense situation. Families want to do everything that they can to bring somebody home, yet they don't have any power. They're completely held ransom to whether or not there's going to be engagement with their story.
Bruce Morcombe, in the last minute that we have for this discussion, what would you recommend for families who have missing persons in their lives, particularly at a time like this when these stories are everywhere in the media? What's helped you cope at various points?
It might sound peculiar, but to try and remain positive and appreciate that you cannot undo what has happened in the past. So don't have regrets in terms of, I wish I'd done this or that. It's very much about being in the moment and looking forward. So if there's something additional you can do, I would certainly recommend that, that will be helpful. But don't look in the past and wish, because you're just going to push yourself into a dark place. But I would urge everyone in Australia, it's a tough call, but I know Sarah does it, and I know I have to do it, and our family does it a couple of times a year. There's International Missing Children's Day in May. There's National Missing Children's Week in August. And any time of the year, jump on the National Missing Persons website and comb through those cases, those thumbnail photos, and who knows, you might hold the secret to actually finding somebody that has been a long-term missing person and return them to their family and assist That'd be remarkable. But please jump on the website. That's the key.
Yeah.
And do your own little bit of research.
Yep. Every little bit helps. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bruce Morecambe from the Daniel Morecambe Foundation. And we'll pop a link to that up on our website too. Dr. Sarah Whalen, thank you for joining us on Life Matters.
Thanks so much.
Sarah's a missing persons researcher at the University of New England. And the National Missing Persons Coordination Centre, we'll pop a link to them on our website too. They've just put their latest missing persons post up on their Facebook page. Stella Ferrugia, Yu Chen Jin, Frederick Bamboo, you may be able to help find one of those people. You never know. If this story has raised any issues you'd like to speak to someone about, Lifeline is always available, 13 11 14. And in a moment, humble beginnings, racism, success at a young age, and intense public scrutiny. It's a pretty potent mix. We'll find out how that played out for the AFL's first African-Australian star, Majak Dore, next on Life Matters.